Okay, let's turn to Acts chapter 21. We're going to start back in chapter 21 again. We're still looking at those consequences of Paul's trying to placate the legalistic Jews down in Jerusalem. Remember, he was talked into this by the elders of the church down in Jerusalem. And this is one of those things that happens where you make a decision and one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. In fact, the decision that Paul made to try and placate these legalists down in Jerusalem is going to determine the course of events for the rest of the book of Acts. That's, we'll be looking at the fallout from that decision throughout the rest of the book of Acts. So let's just try to catch up to where we are again. Remember, the whole thing started back in chapter 21, starting at verse 17, when Paul arrived back from his third missionary journey, and he came back to Jerusalem. And in verse 17, it says, "After we arrived in Jerusalem, the brethren received us gladly. And the following day, Paul went with us to James, and all the elders were present. After he had greeted them, he began to relate one by one the things which God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. And when they heard it, they began glorifying God. And they said to him, 'You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed.'" So their reaction to Paul's message that the Gentiles had been coming to God through his ministry was, yeah, that's great, but look at all the Jews that are believers, and they're all zealous for the law. Verse 21, "And they have been told about you, that you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, nor to walk according to the customs." Now, there's no evidence that Paul actually ever taught that. It was just what they had said about him. So what did they decide to do? Verse 22 says, "What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Therefore, do this that we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take them and purify yourself along with them and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads, and all will know that there is nothing to the things which they have been told about you, but that you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law." So he decides to try and placate the Jews by participating in a public temple service. Well, that doesn't turn out so well, as we see down at verse 30. In verse 30 and 31, the Jews, instead of being placated, try to kill him. And in verse 30, it says, "Then all the city was provoked, and the people rushed together, and taking hold of Paul, they dragged him out of the temple, and immediately the doors were shut." And we noted when we studied this that they shut the doors to the inner temple to prevent blood from spattering in and defiling the temple. So they were out to kill him. Then in verse 31, it says, "While they were seeking to kill him." So they're all set to kill Paul, and he's rescued then by the Roman commander. In the last part of verse 31, it says, "A report came up to the commander of the Roman cohort that all Jerusalem was in confusion. At once he took some soldiers and centurions and ran down to them, and when they saw the commander and the soldiers, they stopped beating Paul." So he had to be rescued by the Romans. Well, Paul asked the Roman commander then for permission to defend himself to these Jewish people, and we have that up in 39 and 40 of chapter 21, where it says, "But Paul said, 'I am a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city. I beg you, allow me to speak to the people.' When he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand. And when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect." So Paul defends himself before the Jewish people. Now this doesn't go so well either, because when he gets to the part about Gentile salvation apart from Judaism, the Jews try to kill him again. In verse chapter 22, down at verse 21, it says, "And he said to me," and that this is Paul reporting what the Lord said to him, said, and he said to me, go, for I will send you far away to the Gentiles. And that throws the crowd into an uproar again. And in verse 22, it says, they listened to him up to this statement, and then they raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live. So they try to kill him again. And again, the Roman commander rescues Paul down at verse 24. It says the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks. So he rescues him from the crowd into the barracks. And the commander, whose job it is to find out what's going on, orders him to be scourged. That's verse 24 in the last part. He said, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks, stating that he should be examined by scourging so that he might find out the reason why they were shouting against him that way. Well, Paul mentions that he's a Roman citizen at this point, and that stops the scourging order in its tracks, because it was illegal to scourge a Roman citizen. Then down in verse 30 it says, but on the next day, wishing to know for certain why he had been accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the council to assemble. So the Roman commander cancels the scourging order, and he calls a meeting of the Sanhedrin so he can find out why the Jews hate Paul so much, because they're throwing the whole city into an uproar. And it's his job to keep the peace. He wants to know what's going on. So in chapter 23 then, Paul defends himself against the Sanhedrin. See how this is going? One thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to another. And in chapter 23, Paul defends himself before the Sanhedrin. Look at verse 1 where it says, Paul, looking intently at the council, said, brethren, I have lived my life with a perfectly good conscience before God up to this day. And Paul's defense before the Sanhedrin, probably not surprising, but it throws them into a rage. Look at verse 10. It says, and as a great dissension was developing, the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them and ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. So the Roman commander has to rescue Paul again because the Sanhedrin's going to tear him to pieces. Then in verse 12 of chapter 23, since the Roman commander keeps stepping in and rescuing Paul, the Jews hatch a plot to murder him. And in verse 12, it says, when it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves under an oath, saying that they would neither eat nor drink until they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who formed this plot. They came to the chief priests and the elders and said, we have bound ourselves under a solemn oath to taste nothing until we have killed Paul. Now, therefore, you and the council notify the commander to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case by a more thorough investigation. And we, for our part, are ready to slay him before he comes near the place. And the council goes along with this. The Jewish Sanhedrin, the ruling religious body of the Jews, goes along with this plot to murder Paul. And of course, they think they're doing God's will and God's business by killing this guy. But they go along with him. But the plot is uncovered by Paul's nephew. And the Roman commander sends Paul to Caesarea. He's just too hot to handle in Jerusalem. So he sends him away for his safety. And Caesarea is the home of the Roman procurator. So that's why he sends him there. It would be kind of a capital city type place. Verse 23, the Roman commander moves Paul to Caesarea, where it says, and he called to him two of the centurions and said, get 200 soldiers ready by the third hour of the night to proceed to Caesarea with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. So this is for one guy to take him down to Caesarea. So they're really prepared for a lot of trouble from these Jews. And verse 24, they were also to provide mounts to put Paul on and bring him safely to Felix, the governor. So Paul now, as we get to chapter 24, and that's where we left off, as we get to chapter 24, Paul is now going to defend himself against the Roman governor or procurator, and his name was Felix. Now, a procurator was a military official. So this guy is a military official, not a politician as such, but a military official, and he held really a lot of power in the Roman Empire. In fact, a procurator had control over entire countries in the Roman system. So this was a very, very powerful man. They had the authority to issue death warrants, and Felix was notorious for doing that, especially against people who rebelled against Roman authority. And that's, we're going to find out, the Jews are going to charge Paul with rebelling against Roman authority. And in fact, these guys were so powerful that they could have coins struck in their name. I mean, this was a pretty powerful position. And Felix was the procurator of Judea. So that's where we find ourselves. Now, as far as the rest of the book of Acts go, it's going to be Paul in front of the Romans. Now, he's going to defend himself to the Romans in chapter 24 through 26. In chapter 24, we'll see Paul before the Roman procurator Felix. And then in chapter 25, 1 through 22, Paul will defend himself before Festus. And then Paul before Agrippa in 25:23 through chapter 26. Now, it's going to be interesting to note as we look at these defenses. We've seen Paul defend himself against the Jews. He defended himself against the Jewish people. He defended himself against the Sanhedrin. And in both cases, a riot broke out and they tried to tear him limb from limb. Now, we're going to find that Paul will get more justice from the Roman legal system than he ever got from the Jews. As we go through this, we'll see that the Roman system is going to be orderly, and he's just going to get more justice there. It's kind of ironic that he gets more justice before the Roman officials than he does the Jewish officials. And then in chapter 27 and 28, Paul's trip to Rome will finish out the book of Acts. Chapter 27 will give us the beginning of the journey. And then in chapter 28, 1 through 10, there will be a delay. And in verse 11 through 31, through the end of the book of Acts, then his journey to Rome will be completed. So that's where we're headed in the book of Acts. And it all keys off of that decision that Paul made to try and placate the legalists down in Jerusalem. So let's look at Paul before Felix now in Acts chapter 24. And this chapter breaks down into three sections. First, we'll have the charges in verse 1 through 9. Then we'll have the defense in verse 10 through 21. And the response in verse 22 through 27. So let's read the first section, which is where I plan to get tonight, in chapter 24, verse 1 through 9. After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders, with an attorney named Tertullus, and they brought charges to the governor against Paul. After Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying to the governor, "Since we have through you attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation, we acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness. But that I may not weary you any further, I beg you to grant us by your kindness a brief hearing. For we have found this man a real pest, and a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. And he even tried to desecrate the temple. And then we arrested him. We wanted to judge him according to our own law. But Lysias, the commander, came along, and with much violence took him out of our hands, ordering his accusers to come before you. By examining him yourself concerning all these matters, you will be able to ascertain the things of which we accuse him. The Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were so." So those are the charges against Paul. And if you've been following along here on Wednesday nights, you'll notice that Tertullus has things a little bit differently than they actually happened when he tells this story. But we'll get to that as we come and go down through the charges. The first thing we have to do is make a note on the timing here. In verse 1, it says, "After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders." Now, the only reason I mention this is because some people take this verse and they couple it with verse 11 and they say, well, the Bible contradicts itself. It's hopelessly contradictory. Because verse 1 says, after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders. Down in 11, it says, "Since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago, I went up to Jerusalem to worship." So if you take those two numbers, if you take the 12 days, it says 12 days ago, Paul went to Jerusalem. So he arrived in Jerusalem, say, 12 days ago. And then he got down to Caesarea, and 5 days later, Ananias shows up. But if you look, chapter 21, and remember, chapter 21 is when he arrived down in Jerusalem. And down in verse 27, remember what they told him to do. Paul was to go with these guys to placate the legalists. He was to go with these guys who had taken a vow, and he was to pay their expenses so they could shave their heads and complete the vow. And down at verse 27, it says, "When the 7 days were almost over." So the vow took 7 days. So if you take the 7 days that Paul was in Jerusalem, plus the 5 days from the time he got to Caesarea until Ananias and Tertullus arrived, that's 12 days, right? What about the travel time? It took a day for him to get from Jerusalem down to Caesarea. So critics of the Bible will say, well, it can't possibly add up. Well, there's actually a couple of very plausible explanations for what this is talking about. And the first thing to remember is that Luke is not likely to make an error like this in his writing. He was a very smart man. In fact, he was a doctor. He was very attentive to detail, as we see throughout the book. So if we assume Luke was telling the truth and that he wasn't confused, we can have a couple of different explanations. And the one is, it says in chapter 24, after 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down. The question is, after 5 days from what? Now, you could assume that it's 5 days from when Paul got to Caesarea, but it doesn't say so anywhere. So what is the 5 days from? Could have been, and some say, that it was 5 days from the time Paul was arrested, which would add up right. And there's another way of looking at it. When you look back at chapter 21, and it talks about the 7 days of the vow, it doesn't say Paul participated in the entire vow. It said he was to participate in the shaving the heads part, and that was done at the end of the vow. So he could have come into the vow while these guys were already well into it. And I just wanted to point that out. And it's one of the minor things that some people use, but it is a verse that's used to discredit the Bible, to say it isn't correct. And there are very plausible explanations for it. And in fact, there are plenty plausible explanations for any apparent discrepancy we see in the Bible. And that's all we need to do, isn't it? Is to offer a plausible explanation. If somebody comes at you with this, just, I have a plausible explanation for that. How can you say that it's that the Bible is incorrect when there's a good explanation? But in fact, the first thing you should always do if somebody comes at you with criticizing the Bible and telling you it isn't correct is to make sure they have their facts straight. Because most people who try to discredit the Bible don't know much about the Bible. And they'll just pick up this stuff here and there, you know. And in fact, as believers, we have a tendency to be intimidated by these people and not to check whether they have their facts right or not. In fact, I'll give you an example, and I don't have the exact quotes. I only thought of this today. But I remember when I was reading about the Scopes trial, you all know the monkey trials in 1925, the Scopes trial, the Clarence Darrow was orating, and he was trying to discredit the Bible. And he mentioned some verses, and he didn't quote them, he just quoted the references. And he says, well, the Bible is wrong about mathematics, and he gave a verse reference. And I'm sorry, I don't have it right on hand, but you can look through the transcripts of the Scopes trial and see it. But you know what? That verse didn't exist. It was in a chapter that didn't exist. And nobody questioned him. Not one person told him that your facts are wrong. So we need to not be intimidated by these people. We need to first make sure they have their facts straight. Because most of them don't. Most of them really don't know much about the Bible. And then if you're still in trouble, I can point you to some resources. So don't ever be intimidated by these kind of folks, because there are plausible explanations. Speaking of attorneys like Clarence Darrow, let's move on to chapter 24 and look at the charge of the Jews. Notice that Ananias, the high priest, brought an attorney along with him. The word attorney is kind of an interesting word in Greek. It's the word praetor. Praetor, we get the English word rhetoric from this word. The genitive of the word is rhetoros. We get the word rhetoric from it. Actually, it means a speaker in court. And the word orator comes from the Latin form of the word. Now, as we start chapter 24, notice that the high priest came down and he brought along a lawyer. Now, this text doesn't say anything about the 40 Jews who conspired to kill Paul. In fact, they're never mentioned again. Maybe they starved to death because they vowed not to eat until they killed him. I'm kidding. Remember last week I said there were ways out of those vows. But there's no mention of these guys or the Asian Jews. And remember, the Asian Jews are the ones who started the whole thing back in chapter 21. Now we have a personal vendetta. It's Ananias, and he brings a lawyer. Remember Ananias, Paul really laid into him back in chapter 23 and verse 3. When he said, then Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Do you sit to try me according to the law and in violation of the law order me to be struck? So Paul put this guy right in his place, and he is really upset. So when Paul is taken to Caesarea, they call, actually the Roman commander at Jerusalem calls for the accusing Jews to go down there and present their side of the case. And here shows up Ananias, and he's got an attorney with him. Now, this is unusual in itself, because normally the high priest himself would present the charges. He wouldn't bring a mouthpiece with him, but Ananias does. So we see that he's really out to get Paul. He's really offended by what Paul told him, and he brings some guys with him. As you see down at verse 9, it says the Jews also joined in the attack. So he had a delegation with him. I take it, since the delegation was so anti-Paul, that they were probably the Sadducee side of the Sanhedrin, because the Pharisee side didn't think Paul was all that bad. They said, we don't see anything bad about this man's doctrine, because they believed in resurrection. The Sadducees didn't. And that was the point that really got to him. So here we have Ananias. He brought his lawyer, and he brought some very anti-Paul Jews along with him. And he makes up a charge that is really devious. And actually, there'll be three charges made against Paul. Now, Tertullus plays up the emotional angle of this. Look at verse 5. It says, "For we have found this man a real pest." Now, what kind of a charge is that? When you take a guy to court, "This guy's a pest. He's been pestering me. Would you put him to death, please?" You know, he's really playing up the emotions here. And in fact, the word pest here, it's kind of a euphemism. The word literally means a diseased bird of prey. A diseased bird of prey. So this charge, the charges are going to be totally biased. They're going to be totally emotional, and they're going to be totally trumped up, so to speak, against Paul. And there's going to be three charges. The first two charges they actually make, after saying that Paul is a diseased bird of prey, the first two charges they actually make would carry a death penalty under Roman law. And the third charge they make, that is the charge of desecrating the temple, would carry a death penalty under Jewish law. And remember, the Romans upheld the Jews when they killed someone who desecrated the temple. They upheld the decisions. So these are three charges that all could result in a death penalty for Paul. Now, Paul, in his defense, is going to answer each one in order, and we'll get to that next week. But right now, we want to look at the charges. So the charges were devious. The next thing we notice is that the judge was corrupt. And in fact, Felix, well, there are two historians that talk about him, Tacitus and Josephus, and both of these historians paint him as a brutal, incompetent politician, and he had to be replaced. Now, Tacitus said this about him: "He exercised the powers of a king with the mind of a slave." And remember how they felt about slaves. Slaves were just above dirt in the social order, you know. So, and that's what Tacitus said about him. So, and in fact, if you look down at verse 25, that we won't get to this week. Verse 25, it talks about, well, it says, "But as he was discussing righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix became frightened and said, 'Go away for the present, and when I find time, I will summon you.' At the same time, too, he was hoping that money would be given him by Paul." So he's kind of looking for a bribe here, you know. He wasn't really what you'd call a nice guy. He was corrupt. So when you get to verse 2 and 3, actually through 4, verse 2 through 4, and we see Tertullus, and he starts his accusation with blatant flattery, just pure flattery. Look at verse 2. It says, "After Paul had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying to the governor, 'Since we have through you attained much peace, and since by your providence reforms are being carried out for this nation, we acknowledge this in every way and everywhere, most excellent Felix, with all thankfulness. But that I may not weary you any further, I beg you to grant us by your kindness a brief hearing.'" Now, this is the guy I was just talking about, the corrupt official. First he says, "We have through you attained much peace." And that's kind of true in a way. They did attain peace. Tacitus, that Roman historian, he said this about the Roman peace. And keep in mind that Tacitus was a Roman. He said, "The Romans create desolation and call it peace." Now, what he means by that is, you know, if they completely destroy something, it's really peaceful. There was peace because the Romans conquered everybody there was to conquer. Now, this always reminds me of something, and I have to tell us. I don't know how many of you remember, but when I was a kid, there was a TV show called The Rifleman. Anybody remember The Rifleman? And on this show, the star was a farmer, and he was a gentle, peace-loving guy. And he used to kill 3-4 people every episode, you know, and I kind of came to the conclusion that he killed people because he thought dead bodies were peaceful. And that's kind of like the Roman peace, you know. They would completely desolate a territory and call it the Pax Romana, the peace of Rome. That's what Tacitus said. And look, and here we have Tertullus saying, since we have through you attained much peace. It's pure flattery. In fact, he used the word, and since by your providence, that term providence, pronoia, is a word normally used of God, the providence of God. Just to give Tertullus his due, it was customary to open an argument before a judge with a compliment. That was traditional. In fact, Paul will do the same thing when he opens his defense. But there's a difference. Paul's compliment is based on fact. It's not just a trumped-up flattery. Look down at verse 10. It says, when the governor had nodded for him to speak, Paul responded, knowing that for many years you have been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. And that's true. And he says, since you can take note of the fact that for many years you have been a judge to this nation, and it's very true that Felix was very familiar with Jewish law. So that compliment was true. So there's a difference between the compliments. Now in verse 5 through 8, we have the charges themselves, and we see, if you remember from the scene at the Sanhedrin, that things are a little bit different in Tertullus' story than they actually happened. In his account, the Jews were just proceeding in an orderly manner. They were going to arrest Paul, and the Romans broke in with much violence. Look at verse 5. It says, for we have found this man a real pest and a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. And he even tried to desecrate the temple. And then we arrested him. We wanted to judge him according to our own law, but Lysias, the commander, came along and with much violence took him out of our hands, ordering his accusers to come before you. Now, does this track with what we've been looking at in these passages? Doesn't track at all. The Sanhedrin was about to tear Paul limb from limb. Lysias stepped in and saved his life. So they're embellishing things a bit. Now, the charges they make are going to proceed from general to specific. And first, there'll be two sets of charges under two different legal systems, the Roman and the Jewish. And again, the penalty in both of these cases is death. Now, the first charge, it says, after he says he's a pest and a fellow who stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world. So the first charge is that he stirs up dissension among all the Jews throughout the world. Now, dissension is a word that means rebellion or sedition. The idea is that it's rebellion against the Roman authority. Now, if it was just stirring up trouble, they could make a really good case. Remember, we've been looking at the book of Acts. What happened to Paul? He was expelled from Pisidian Antioch. I wrote some things down here. He was stoned at Lystra. He was scourged and imprisoned at Philippi, accused of treason at Thessalonica. He was brought before the proconsul in Corinth and caused a riot in Jerusalem. So Paul might have had what they call on TV a yellow sheet, you know, a criminal record, because he had caused trouble, but he never, ever promoted rebellion against the Roman authority. And that's what they're trying to charge him with here. Now, that would have been a capital charge in a Roman court. And Felix, of all people, would be a bad one to be standing in front of if you were promoting rebellion against the Roman authority, because he had a reputation for crucifying rebels. He had a big reputation for that. So the intent of this charge is to show that Paul was not a religious offender, which the Romans didn't care anything about, but he was a political offender. He was trying to generate a rebellion. That was their charge. Again, he calls them a pest. Loimos literally means a diseased bird of prey. It came to mean a plague or a pestilence. Look back at Luke 21 and you see another example of that word. In Luke 21:11, at verse 10 it says, "Then he continued by saying to them, nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be great earthquakes and in various places plagues and famines." And that word plagues is the same word that we have over in Acts 24. So the lawyer for the Jews calls Paul a plague or a pestilence. So obviously it's a very derogatory term. Charge number two, he calls him a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Now, ringleader is a word that means one who stands first. Actually, it's a military term. It's kind of an interesting word because in the ranks of soldiers in the Roman army, you know, they all marched in rows and ranks. And the one who determined the way the detachment would go was in the front row on the right-hand side. That's where they put the guy who was kind of led the group of soldiers around. And that's what this word refers to. The guy who's in the front row on the right-hand side, he's the one that leads everything along. Charge three, he even tried to desecrate the temple in verse 6. And he even tried to desecrate the temple. Remember, this was based on the rumor that Paul had brought a Gentile into the temple. Look back at chapter 21 again. In verse 27, talking about the vow that these guys had taken. When the 7 days were almost over, the Jews from Asia, upon seeing him in the temple, began to stir up all the crowd and laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, come to our aid. This is the man who preaches to all men everywhere against our people and the law and this place. And besides, he has even brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. For they had previously seen Trophimus the Ephesian in the city with him, and they supposed that Paul had brought him into the temple." So they had seen Trophimus with Paul in the city. When they saw Paul in the temple, they said, "Oh, I'll bet he's got Trophimus with him. Let's start a riot." And they started a riot and tried to kill him. Then back in chapter 24, again in verse 6, it's a complete distortion of the facts where he says, and he even tried to desecrate the temple, and then we arrested him, like they were just being peaceful, law-abiding folks. Was the Jews who were trying to kill Paul. They didn't arrest him at all. And then in verse 8, the last part of verse 8 and verse 9, we have the conclusion. And apparently, the account that we have in Acts 24 is probably not the entire speech, but the highlights of the speech. And we have the summary in verse 8. It says, "By examining him yourself concerning all these matters, you will be able to ascertain the things of which we accuse him. The Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were so also." Actually, Tertullus's speech kind of trails away there, doesn't it? It just says, well, you'll see. You'll be able to see when you examine him. And again, perhaps it's only a summary of the speech that Luke gives us here. But anyway, the delegation from the Sanhedrin seems to be satisfied with him. In verse 9, it says, "The Jews also joined in the attack, asserting that these things were so." So those are the charges against Paul before the Roman governor, Felix. Now next time, we'll look at Paul's defense to those charges, and he's going to defend very logically, very orderly, and we'll pick up there then in verse 10 next time. Father, thank you for the book of Acts and your inspired church history, and thank you for this account that you've given us of Paul's defense before the Romans. In Christ's name we pray, amen.